"Emergency," bellowed a computer-synthesized voice. "Life support system will fail in 1 minute. 1 minute to life support failure." Dan hollered over the warning system's announcement. "In 1 minute, this entire level of offices will be opened to vacuum. I suggest you haul your asses out into the corridor and run like hell to the nearest emergency hatch. Those hatches are programmed to shut automatically when they sense a drop in air pressure. You don't want to be on the wrong side of a hatch when it slams shut."
"You're bluffing," Kate snarled.
45 seconds to life support failure. 45 seconds. Dan shrugged. "Sure I am. And rain makes applesauce." He backed away, still pointing the pistol at them, and felt for his private door behind him. The urgent wail of the warning siren seemed to grow louder, more shrill. 40 seconds to life support failure. Jane got to her feet.
"I don't know about the rest of you," she said, and started for the door to the outer office.
"Hey," Dan called after her. "Don't you want to come with me?" Jane hesitated only an instant. Then she shook her head and kept on going. "You always were a smart lady," Dan called after her. "See you." 30 seconds to life support failure. 30 seconds. Kate and the others suddenly bolted for the outer office in safety, leaving the unconscious Burrhead sprawled on the floor. Laughing, Dan opened his private door and stepped into the back corridor. He could hear the automated warning voice calling out 20 seconds and then 10 seconds as he loped down the corridor toward the hatch that led to the ladderway. Tucking his pistol into a thigh pocket and zippering it shut, Dan opened the hatch and started down the steel rungs of the ladder. He heard very faintly, "This has been a test of the emergency warning system. Thank you for your cooperation. All personnel may return to their normal stations. This test is concluded." Chuckling to himself at the picture of Kate Williams's face when she heard that, Dan clambered down 5 levels to the very bottom of the tube-like ladderway. There was no hatch down here. He merely stepped out into the dimly lit bottom level of Alphonsus City, a world of machinery where humans rarely bothered to go. Most of the machinery was for life support. The air scrubbers and fans, electrical inverters and routing substations, water purification systems and recirculators. The very air hummed, throbbed like the giant mechanical heart of the city that it actually was. Dan knew that there were teams of teleoperators up above, sitting in their comfortable offices and keeping tabs electronically on the machines down here. They had video cameras, too, so they could keep the entire section under visual surveillance. He knew also that, like inspectors anywhere, the men and women responsible for monitoring this equipment rarely paid attention to their work, except when a warning light flashed red or a synthesized voice warned of trouble that the computer's sensors had detected. "Until they're specifically told to search for me," Dan told himself, "they won't be looking for anybody prowling around down here. I hope." He made his way through the shadowy light toward the tunnel that he knew existed at the back end of this bottom level. He had helped to carve it out of the bedrock of Alphonsus's Ringwall Mountains, back in the days when he operated a plasma torch and alternately drank and fought with his Japanese co-workers. One of the few mobile maintenance robots suddenly came from behind a ceiling-high electrical transformer. Dan almost bumped into it. The robot was one of the newer models, almost 6 feet tall and gleaming in the far-spaced overhead lights. Its head bore 2 round camera lenses where eyes would be, and a speaker grill in place of a mouth. It had 4 arms, each ending in fully rotatable pincers with the strength to break bones.
"Unauthorized personnel are not allowed in this area," said the robot's tinny synthesized voice in Japanese.
Crapola. "If I exceed this double-damned tin can's programmed commands, it'll send a warning buzz to the operators upstairs." Thinking quickly, Dan replied in Japanese, "This is an unannounced routine inspection tour."
"Authorization code?" asked the robot.
Dan pecked at his wristwatch for the last authorization code he had received from the system months ago. His trembling fingers fumbled with the tiny keypad, and the phone's miniature screen lit up with "birthday." Dan fumed and tried to find the information he needed. "If Bozo here detects the gun in my pocket..."
"Authorization code?"
the robot repeated. There it was. Hoping that the code had not been changed over the intervening months, Dan rattled off the numbers.
"Thank you," said the robot.
It turned and trundled away. Dan was only slightly shaken when he saw that the machine had an identical face on the other side of its head. "I've heard of two-faced women," he muttered to himself as he resumed his hurried pace toward the tunnel. "But robots? That's weird." The tunnel had been started back in the days when Yamagata Industries had first decided to make a major manufacturing center at Alphonsus. Saito's father had decided to ram a tunnel through the Ringwall Mountains, connecting the floor of Alphonsus with the broad expanse of Mare Nubium. The lunar rock had turned out to be much tougher than expected. The costs of digging the tunnel, even with plasma torches, had risen too far. So the tunnel was never finished. Instead, a cable car system had been built over the mountains. It was more expensive to operate than a tunnel would have been, but far cheaper to construct. It was still in use. But the tunnel was still there, incomplete, unused for nearly two decades, but still there. So were the access shafts that had been drilled upward to the face of the mountain. The first of those access shafts opened into an emergency shelter where there were pressure suits and spare oxygen bottles in case the cable car system overhead broke down. That was Dan's objective. Alphonsus City, like any settlement built in the harsh, airless environment of the moon, was a tightly sealed, closely controlled community. No one got into a cable car or stepped through an airlock without being scrutinized. You could walk for miles inside the main plaza or along the city's corridors, but there were always video monitors watching. The monitors were there for safety, but they could easily be used to find a fugitive. Dan mused as he made his way toward the tunnel that there had been amazingly few fugitives, to his knowledge. In a community as large as Alphonsus City had grown to be, there were bound to be some thieves or perverts or the occasional case of murderous violence. But living and working on the moon apparently sorted out the unstable types very quickly. They killed themselves, and often killed those unfortunate enough to be near them when they screwed up. He grinned to himself as he realized that most of the inhabitants of Alphonsus were Japanese. Sure, there might have been a few with larcenous souls among them, but by and large they worked hard, obeyed the regulations, and lived frugally. He remembered the rare thief that had been caught and brought to trial. Usually it was white-collar stuff. A bartender stiffing his employer, a logistics clerk jiggering the computer system so he could sell company equipment on the black market. There is a black market here, he knew, but it's usually so small and harmless that it's not worth the trouble going after it. As far back as he could remember, though, there had been no real fugitives from justice at Alphonsus City. Or any other lunar settlement. You can't go out and hide in the hills. Not on a world where the only air and water is manufactured in the cities. There had been a few disappearances, of course. That was to be expected on a harshly unforgiving frontier world. But no fugitives. Not until now. The tunnel entrance was closed, but the electronic lock on the metal hatch was easy enough to decipher. He had expected the hinges to squeal painfully since the door probably had not been touched in years, but it opened smoothly, quietly. Are the robots programmed to oil the hinges? Dan wondered. The air inside smelled dusty, stale. He coughed. But it was air. It was breathable if you didn't mind the sensation of fine talcum powder choking your throat. There was no light. Dan had forgotten to bring a torch with him, and the dim light from the basement quickly petered out in the depths of the tunnel. He felt his way along the rough side of the tunnel, thankful that this was on the moon, and there'd be no unpleasant critters slithering around in the darkness. Wrong. A pair of tiny, burning red eyes stared balefully at him out of the shadows, shoulder high. Dan felt his heart clutch in his chest, then realized that it was the indicator lights of an emergency lamp, left there years ago by the construction gang, still powered by its radioisotope system. His fingers found the lamp's square shape in the darkness and slid across gritty dust until they touched its activating switch. The sudden light made Dan squint, but his eyes quickly adjusted. It was easier going with the lamp. In a few minutes, Dan found the hatch to the access tunnel and started climbing up the ladder toward the emergency shelter up on the surface. As far as he knew, the access tunnel had never been used to rescue stranded cable car passengers. Never had to be. The cable system had worked fine ever since it had been erected, Except for a few minor glitches that stranded cars for an hour or less,